This is the Cambridge Assessment International Education, Cambridge IGCSE, November 2023 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 3. Listening. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Exercise 1. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words or a number for each answer. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. What time did the boy catch the bus? B. What did the boy leave on the bus?
Hi, I'm calling to report a lost item on one of your buses. I was taking the number 52 from Silver Street to the college this morning. It was due at Silver Street at 8:15, but it was a bit late and didn't turn up until 8:20. It arrived at the college, where I got off, at 9 o'clock. Anyway, my phone rang just before we reached my stop, and I was so busy answering that I completely forgot about my backpack, which was under my seat. It's blue, by the way. Luckily, my college ID card wasn't in it. My number is 0721 966 589. Hi, I'm calling to report a lost item on one of your buses. I was taking the number 52 from Silver Street to the college this morning. It was due at Silver Street at 8:15, but it was a bit late and didn't turn up until 8:20. It arrived at the college, where I got off, at 9 o'clock. Anyway, my phone rang just before we reached my stop, and I was so busy answering that I completely forgot about my backpack, which was under my seat. It's blue, by the way. Luckily, my college ID card wasn't in it. My number is 0721 966 589.
Question 2. A. Where will the girl go after school? B. What is the girl going to take with her?
Are you still okay to play tennis after school?
Oh, I completely forgot we were supposed to be going to the tennis club. Actually, can we postpone it till tomorrow? Because I've got to be at the hospital this afternoon. My cousin's had a baby, a little boy.
Sure, no problem. And that's great news. Have you got something for the baby?
I have, a soft toy. But my cousin said we should save giving things like that till they're both back at home. She was desperate for some chocolate, though, so I picked some up for her yesterday.
Well, pass on my best wishes to her.
Will do.
Are you still okay to play tennis after school?
Oh, I completely forgot we were supposed to be going to the tennis club. Actually, can we postpone it till tomorrow? Because I've got to be at the hospital this afternoon. My cousin's had a baby, a little boy.
Sure, no problem. And that's great news. Have you got something for the baby?
I have, a soft toy. But my cousin said we should save giving things like that till they're both back at home. She was desperate for some chocolate, though, so I picked some up for her yesterday.
Well, pass on my best wishes to her.
Will do.
Question 3. A. Who did the boy go to the museum with? B. How many hours did the boy spend at the museum?
How was your weekend?
Great. I went to a new museum that's all about the Earth.
Sounds interesting.
It was, and my stepfather thought so too. I'm so glad my little brother had something else to do. He'd have hated it and would have wanted to leave as soon as we'd arrived. There were sections on how the Earth was formed, how and when life appeared, and all sorts of other stuff.
Right.
We ended up spending 7 hours in the city centre, 5 of them looking at the wonderful exhibitions, and 2 more afterwards at a restaurant near the museum getting something to eat.
What a great day out! How was your weekend?
Great. I went to a new museum that's all about the Earth.
Sounds interesting.
It was, and my stepfather thought so too. I'm so glad my little brother had something else to do. He'd have hated it and would have wanted to leave as soon as we'd arrived. There were sections on how the Earth was formed, how and when life appeared, and all sorts of other stuff.
Right.
We ended up spending 7 hours in the city centre, 5 of them looking at the wonderful exhibitions, and 2 more afterwards at a restaurant near the museum getting something to eat.
What a great day out!
Question 4. A. What must the woman do before leaving home for her business trip? B. How is the woman going to travel to the airport?
So, you're ready for the trip to New York?
More or less. I've never travelled so far on business before, or for so long. Anyway, I managed to pack my suitcase first thing this morning, so all that's left to do is lock the windows and then off I go.
How are you getting to the airport?
Well, taking a taxi seemed by far the best option when I considered all the things that can go wrong on public transport. I mean, the train's really fast, but I'm not sure it's actually that reliable.
Well, have a safe trip.
Thanks.
So, you're ready for the trip to New York?
More or less. I've never travelled so far on business before, or for so long. Anyway, I managed to pack my suitcase first thing this morning, so all that's left to do is lock the windows and then off I go.
How are you getting to the airport?
Well, taking a taxi seemed by far the best option when I considered all the things that can go wrong on public transport. I mean, the train's really fast, but I'm not sure it's actually that reliable.
Well, have a safe trip.
Thanks.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear exercise 2. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 2. You will hear a marine biologist called Ruth Harper giving a talk about an unusual fish called a seahorse. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Hi everyone. I've come to talk to you today about a small and unusual looking type of fish called a seahorse. As you probably know, they're called this because their heads resemble those of a horse. I found various figures on the internet for how many different species of seahorse there are. 54 is mentioned on several sites, while on others numbers range from 46, which is the correct one, to 100. Part of the problem in identifying different types of seahorse comes from one of their cleverest abilities, which they use to escape from animals that want to eat them. Unlike many sea creatures, which can swim fast to avoid danger, seahorses have to rely on their ability to change colour to do this. So, where do seahorses live? Well, they're found in many places worldwide. They're restricted to the shallow areas of the seas where they live, though, rather than making their homes in deeper water. Unusually, the roles of male and female seahorses are the opposite to many other animals. For example, it's actually male seahorses that give birth to young. Although using body size to tell the difference between females and males is pointless, as neither is larger than the other, watching how far they move around where they live does provide a clue. While the territory of a male seahorse is typically just half a square metre, that of the female can be 200 times bigger. So, what do seahorses eat? Well, their diet consists mainly of tiny sea creatures called shrimps. While the hearts of seahorses and their other internal body parts are similar to those of many small fish, they don't have stomachs, which means they have to eat small quantities constantly during the day. I've learned so much about these fascinating animals since I started studying them. I knew that they have excellent eyesight, so they can identify their food without a problem, but I was totally unaware that it's impossible for seahorses to chew it once they catch it. They actually swallow it whole. In common with many sea creatures, seahorse numbers are falling and they need our protection. Unfortunately, this reduction is mainly being caused by people. Every year, we're responsible for the deaths of about 58 million of them. Even if we assume that around 30 million young seahorses are born each year, and that there's a worldwide population of perhaps 300 million, it means many seahorse species will soon be in danger of dying out. Many people find seahorses' unique appearance attractive, so they buy live seahorses to keep in their homes in large glass containers called aquariums. About as many are dried and end up as souvenirs in tourist shops in many regions. The biggest problem, though, is fishing. Although we don't eat seahorses, they're accidentally caught in nets designed to trap other kinds of fish. The use of seahorses in traditional medicine also reduces their numbers greatly. So there are many reasons why these beautiful creatures need our help. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed my talk. Does anyone have any questions?
Now you will hear the talk again.
Hi everyone. I've come to talk to you today about a small and unusual looking type of fish called a seahorse. As you probably know, they're called this because their heads resemble those of a horse. I found various figures on the internet for how many different species of seahorse there are. 54 is mentioned on several sites, while on others numbers range from 46, which is the correct one, to 100. Part of the problem in identifying different types of seahorse comes from one of their cleverest abilities, which they use to escape from animals that want to eat them. Unlike many sea creatures, which can swim fast to avoid danger, seahorses have to rely on their ability to change colour to do this. So, where do seahorses live? Well, they're found in many places worldwide. They're restricted to the shallow areas of the seas where they live, though, rather than making their homes in deeper water. Unusually, the roles of male and female seahorses are the opposite to many other animals. For example, it's actually male seahorses that give birth to young. Although using body size to tell the difference between females and males is pointless, as neither is larger than the other, watching how far they move around where they live does provide a clue. While the territory of a male seahorse is typically just half a square metre, that of the female can be 200 times bigger. So, what do seahorses eat? Well, their diet consists mainly of tiny sea creatures called shrimps. While the hearts of seahorses and their other internal body parts are similar to those of many small fish, they don't have stomachs, which means they have to eat small quantities constantly during the day. I've learned so much about these fascinating animals since I started studying them. I knew that they have excellent eyesight, so they can identify their food without a problem, but I was totally unaware that it's impossible for seahorses to chew it once they catch it. They actually swallow it whole. In common with many sea creatures, seahorse numbers are falling and they need our protection. Unfortunately, this reduction is mainly being caused by people. Every year, we're responsible for the deaths of about 58 million of them. Even if we assume that around 30 million young seahorses are born each year, and that there's a worldwide population of perhaps 300 million, it means many seahorse species will soon be in danger of dying out. Many people find seahorses' unique appearance attractive, so they buy live seahorses to keep in their homes in large glass containers called aquariums. About as many are dried and end up as souvenirs in tourist shops in many regions. The biggest problem, though, is fishing. Although we don't eat seahorses, they're accidentally caught in nets designed to trap other kinds of fish. The use of seahorses in traditional medicine also reduces their numbers greatly. So there are many reasons why these beautiful creatures need our help. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed my talk. Does anyone have any questions?
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear exercise 3. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 3. You will hear 6 people talking about studying in another country. For each of the speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list, A to G, which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
I'm spending a year at a university in Brazil. The way of life here is just as lively as I'd heard it'd be. It's certainly not like where I'm from in Australia. The fact there are so many interesting things to discover has kept me too busy to phone my parents very often. If I could go back in time, I'd have decided on political rather than social science. But otherwise, everything's great, and I've already made almost as many friends here as I've got back home.
Speaker 2.
I get to study at a university in France for a year as part of my degree. The courses are all taught in French, which I've found fairly challenging, even though my French is reasonably good. The others on the course have helped out whenever I've needed it, though, which has been pretty often, to be honest. The university's accommodation's largely, as you'd expect, simple but comfortable enough. I haven't spent that much time there, actually, as I've been out lots enjoying the amazing atmosphere here and making new friends.
Speaker 3.
I'm studying environmental science for 3 years in New Zealand. Some people regret their choice of subject, but it's what I've always wanted to do, and I can't think of a better place to do it, even though I'm thousands of miles away from my mom, dad, and 2 brothers. The description of the university apartment I live in sounded much too good to be true, but it was actually amazingly accurate. My roommates are cool, and it very soon felt as though we'd known each other for years.
Speaker 4.
I'm studying engineering in Japan at the moment.
My mum's from here, and my Japanese is just as good as my English, so keeping up with what the teachers say has never been an issue. My tutors have been great. They've spent loads of time checking that I'm settling in okay and not missing my family too much. Many visitors to Japan get a shock when they arrive, as it's so different to where they're from. I've been here so many times, though, that it feels like a second home.
Speaker 5.
I'm doing part of my psychology degree course here in Sweden. I have no problems understanding course content delivered in English, of course, but when it's in Swedish, well, that's a different matter. Before I came, I thought I'd be desperate to fly back home to the UK every few weeks to see my parents, but I've hardly had time to think about them at all. I'm in a shared house, which is great, as I haven't had to put a great deal of effort into finding new friends.
Speaker 6.
I'm lucky enough to be studying archaeology in Egypt right now. I guess I should have known better, but I assumed that the food and the stores here and the way of doing stuff would be pretty similar to the US. How mistaken I was. But I love it. I don't think I've ever met more welcoming people, and the university staff have been so helpful with day-to-day living problems, as well as course-related concerns. We get to live in a really great quarter of the city, too.
Now you will hear the six speakers again. Speaker 1.
I'm spending a year at a university in Brazil. The way of life here is just as lively as I'd heard it'd be. It's certainly not like where I'm from in Australia. The fact there are so many interesting things to discover has kept me too busy to phone my parents very often. If I could go back in time, I'd have decided on political rather than social science. But otherwise, everything's great, and I've already made almost as many friends here as I've got back home.
Speaker 2.
I get to study at a university in France for a year as part of my degree. The courses are all taught in French, which I've found fairly challenging, even though my French is reasonably good. The others on the course have helped out whenever I've needed it, though, which has been pretty often, to be honest. The university's accommodation's largely, as you'd expect, simple but comfortable enough. I haven't spent that much time there, actually, as I've been out lots enjoying the amazing atmosphere here and making new friends.
Speaker 3.
I'm studying environmental science for 3 years in New Zealand. Some people regret their choice of subject, but it's what I've always wanted to do, and I can't think of a better place to do it, even though I'm thousands of miles away from my mom, dad, and two brothers. The description of the university apartment I live in sounded much too good to be true, but it was actually amazingly accurate. My roommates are cool, and it very soon felt as though we'd known each other for years.
Speaker 4.
I'm studying engineering in Japan at the moment. My mum's from here, and my Japanese is just as good as my English, so keeping up with what the teachers say has never been an issue. My tutors have been great. They've spent loads of time checking that I'm settling in okay and not missing my family too much. Many visitors to Japan get a shock when they arrive, as it's so different to where they're from. I've been here so many times, though, that it feels like a second home.
Speaker 5.
I'm doing part of my psychology degree course here in Sweden. I have no problems understanding course content delivered in English, of course,
but when it's in Swedish, well, that's a different matter. Before I came, I thought I'd be desperate to fly back home to the UK every few weeks to see my parents, but I've hardly had time to think about them at all. I'm in a shared house, which is great, as I haven't had to put a great deal of effort into finding new friends.
Speaker 6.
I'm lucky enough to be studying archaeology in Egypt right now. I guess I should have known better, but I assumed that the food and the stores here and the way of doing stuff would be pretty similar to the U.S. How mistaken I was. But I love it. I don't think I've ever met more welcoming people, and the university staff have been so helpful with day-to-day living problems, as well as course-related concerns. We get to live in a really great quarter of the city, too.
That is the end of Exercise 3. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 4. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 4. You will hear an interview with a man called Michael Pearson, who is talking about his favourite sport, kite surfing. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
I'm delighted to have kite surfer Michael Pearson with me today. For those who don't know, kite surfing involves being pulled across the water on a board by a huge kite. How did you first get into it, Michael?
It all started during a holiday I went on with my cousin. We met someone who did something called power kiting, where you ride along the beach on the sand on what looks like a large skateboard pulled by a big kite. I'd seen power kiting in various videos on the internet and it looked fun, so I tried it and loved it. I carried on doing it, but after 2 years I decided to use the kite on the water instead, with a board I'd made myself. I didn't even realise at that point that it was called kite surfing.
Great! So was it easy for you to begin with?
It was really hard, so I decided to dedicate all the free time I had to improving my skills. The board moved around much more than I was used to, so control was a real issue. I ended up tearing several kites and cracking a couple of boards after crashing into things. At least the coast closest to home turned out to be ideal for kite surfing, though.
But you eventually became good enough to enter competitions?
Yes, but the first one was a disaster. You score points based on successfully doing different tricks, like jumping and turning. I'd only learned how to do three and couldn't even do them very well, so felt like a complete fool. I picked up lots by watching the other competitors, though, especially the guy who won. He was amazing, and I understood then why the public had come out in their hundreds to watch him perform.
I believe you took a break from kite surfing at one point.
Yeah, it wasn't as though I'd lost interest or got into some other sport. I just went too far out to sea one day and had a bit of a panic. I was never really in danger, but it left me shaken enough to avoid the water for a while. I actually told my kitesurfing buddies I'd hurt my back because I didn't want to tell them the truth, but I don't mind admitting it now.
So what benefits do you get from kitesurfing?
Well, the obvious ones like physical fitness, but when I'm doing it, it's like I'm in my own world. I'm not saying my concerns about money and relationships and so on disappear, but ideas for sorting them out just seem to appear in my head as if from nowhere. It's just fantastic. This all happens while I'm having fun too.
And you teach kitesurfing as well these days.
Yeah, I've noticed that I analyse my own technique much more because of it, which leads to improvements for me as well as my students. The more difficult course members remind me what I used to be like, so working out what to say to them isn't too tricky. Fortunately, the school I work for deals with filling out forms and registers and so on. I hate that stuff.
Why do you think kitesurfing's become more popular recently?
There are certainly lots more interest groups online related to kitesurfing, but I think that's a result rather than the cause. It's actually fairly inexpensive, though, as once you've bought the kit, the wind's free, and there's no need to invest in extra equipment for your car to carry the gear, so that's a major factor. Kitesurfing's making its first appearance at the Olympics soon, so that'll hopefully get even more people doing it.
Any advice for those new kitesurfers, Michael?
You'll probably be surprised how good you get in a relatively short space of time, especially with good coaching. And watching videos of yourself kitesurfing can help to identify problems, but perhaps that's more for intermediate-level kitesurfers. Having the appropriate helmet and vest are a must, however good you are, but especially so for people just starting out.
Thanks, Michael.
Now you will hear the interview again.
I'm delighted to have kite surfer Michael Pearson with me today. For those who don't know, kite surfing involves being pulled across the water on a board by a huge kite. How did you first get into it, Michael?
It all started during a holiday I went on with my cousin. We met someone who did something called power kiting, where you ride along the beach on the sand on what looks like a large skateboard pulled by a big kite. I'd seen power kiting in various videos on the internet and it looked fun, so I tried it and loved it. I carried on doing it, but after 2 years I decided to use the kite on the water instead, with a board I'd made myself. I didn't even realise at that point that it was called kite surfing.
Great! So was it easy for you to begin with?
It was really hard, so I decided to dedicate all the free time I had to improving my skills. The board moved around much more than I was used to, so control was a real issue. I ended up tearing several kites and cracking a couple of boards after crashing into things. At least the coast closest to home turned out to be ideal for kite surfing, though.
But you eventually became good enough to enter competitions?
Yes, but the first one was a disaster. You score points based on successfully doing different tricks, like jumping and turning. I'd only learned how to do three, and couldn't even do them very well, so felt like a complete fool. I picked up lots by watching the other competitors, though, especially the guy who won. He was amazing, and I understood then why the public had come out in their hundreds to watch him perform.
I believe you took a break from kitesurfing at one point.
Yeah. It wasn't as though I'd lost interest or got into some other sport. I just went too far out to sea one day and had a bit of a panic. I was never really in danger, but it left me shaken enough to avoid the water for a while. I actually told my kitesurfing buddies I'd hurt my back because I didn't want to tell them the truth, but I don't mind admitting it now.
So what benefits do you get from kitesurfing?
Well, the obvious ones like physical fitness, but when I'm doing it, it's like I'm in my own world. I'm not saying my concerns about money and relationships and so on disappear, but ideas for sorting them out just seem to appear in my head as if from nowhere. It's just fantastic. This all happens while I'm having fun too.
And you teach kitesurfing as well these days.
Yeah. I've noticed that I analyse my own technique much more because of it, which leads to improvements for me as well as my students. The more difficult course members remind me what I used to be like, so working out what to say to them isn't too tricky. Fortunately, the school I work for deals with filling out forms and registers and so on. I hate that stuff.
Why do you think kitesurfing's become more popular recently?
There are certainly lots more interest groups online related to kitesurfing, but I think that's a result rather than the cause. It's actually fairly inexpensive, though, as once you've bought the kit, the wind's free, and there's no need to invest in extra equipment for your car to carry the gear, so that's a major factor. Kitesurfing's making its first appearance at the Olympics soon, so that'll hopefully get even more people doing it.
Any advice for those new kitesurfers, Michael?
You'll probably be surprised how good you get in a relatively short space of time, especially with good coaching. And watching videos of yourself kitesurfing can help to identify problems, but perhaps that's more for intermediate-level kitesurfers. Having the appropriate helmet and vest are a must, however good you are, but especially so for people just starting out.
Thanks, Michael.
That is the end of the interview and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.